New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our soil is rocky and our growing season short, but Granite Staters love their gardens nonetheless. From urban container gardens to backyard vegetable plots to large community growing spaces, people here make the most of the limited months that can truly be called gardening season. And in New Hampshire and nationwide, there's rising interest in growing your own, a steady upward trend in edible vegetable gardening. But as more of us take to the soil, there's a new challenge in addition to the usual frustrations: climate change, with its potential for a longer growing season, but also for more invasive species and a greater likelihood of extreme weather. Today in The Exchange, a panel of Granite State gardening experts joins us to take your questions. So let's hear from you. What's your biggest gardening conundrum this year? What challenges have you faced over the years trying to get things to grow? And what changes have you noticed? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests in this studio. Jane Presby is here, owner, CEO, field supervisor of Diamond Hill Farm in Concord. And Jane, it's great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for asking me.
Also with us, Becky Seidman, extension professor and sustainable horticulture specialist at UNH. And Becky, great to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Henry Holmeyer, lifelong organic gardener, author of a weekly gardening column that appears in 10 newspapers around New England, and the author of 4 books on gardening. And Henry, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Well, and Henry, I want to start with you, but hear from everybody. What sort of a mentality do you need to be a gardener in New Hampshire, given all the challenges of soil and season and weather and whatnot?
You have to be optimistic. There's so much wonderful gardening that can be done. I'm always pushing the limit in terms of what I can grow in terms of flowers and trees and shrubs. Don't limit yourself just because the books tell you that you can't do it.
Speaking as an author of 4 books on gardening, so when you say, you know, you can't do it because why? Because it's just not warm enough here? Or?
Yes. It's easy to grow things in Connecticut, but when you get up here, there's so many flowers that are at the limit of the coldness zones. So when you get 20 below zero, 25 below zero in the winter, it precludes certain trees and shrubs in particular.
So you're saying be playful, take risks, and be willing maybe
to lose a few.
Failure.
To
yeah.
lose a few, yeah.
yeah. Well, and what you're talking about is the hardiness zones, I think, and that's the official map of where you can plant and what you can't. And we've put that up on our Facebook page and our website, by the way, if folks want to take a look at what hardiness zone they're in. What do you think, Jane Presby? What does it take to be a gardener in the Granite State? You have to be made of strong stuff.
Courage. I would say it's definitely courage. Also, I think the more information you can collect about your personal garden and how the garden is set up in the sun, take soil temperatures, when's the appropriate time to put different things in your garden, know when your frost-free date is, know which are your cold crops that can be put in the ground early, which are the warm crops that go in a little later after Memorial Weekend. It's knowing the rhythms of your area, and you'll have, I think, a better experience even going into the fall. Know when your first frost is so you can get your harvest before that happens. It's about the plan, you know, and I think the other thing is it's hard to take a vacation when you have a garden. And I have a lot of people say, you know, I really would like tomatoes. I like to grow them, but I'm going away the second, third, fourth week of August, and that's probably not a good plan.
Well,
since
that's where friends come in, though, right?
Yeah, that's true, too. But I think realistic ideas and goals for gardens, what is it that you need from your garden? When does it come in? And then you can cohabit. So you can have a coexistence that doesn't frustrate you, and you can grow the things you really want to have, you know, happen because you have the time.
Well, so courage, optimism, as Henry said, and knowledge. And you've already said something, Jane, that I didn't know. I've heard about getting your soil tested for lead and pH and whatever, but soil temperature, I never thought of that before. Mm-hmm. So the soil's actually going to be warmer in some parts of your yard than others.
If it's in the sun, south side exposure, you know, if your garden is under trees and You look at your yard and say, what kind of trees do I have in my yard? And you look around and you say, they're all pine trees. So probably your soul is going to be a little acidic. And you look around and say, wow, when does the sun go down? Do I have half-day sun, full sun? All important factors that are practical information that sometimes we forget that you just can't say, wow, the garden for vegetables look great right over there, but it's in the shade most of the day. Your success rate is not going to be all that great if you don't have sun for your vegetables.
Well, I'm guessing that's a common mistake. Becky, what are some of the biggest, well, beginner mistakes or rookie mistakes that you see gardeners in New Hampshire making? I'm hearing Jane on one that she mentioned. Be realistic. A lot of us sort of overreach and say, I'm going to plant everything. It's going to be so great.
That's absolutely true. And I think especially when with the recent increase in people gardening for vegetables for the first time, I think people jump into it really quickly and maybe decide they want to plant a garden in May and haven't given a lot of forethought to where they're going to put it, how they're going to take care of it, and maybe they start too big and it's difficult to manage.
So overreaching, not being realistic. What other rookie mistakes do people make, Becky? And Henry, I want to hear from you too.
Well, I think that Jane touched on a really good point, and that is that New Hampshire forest soils, our natural soils, are really low pH. They're very acidic, and people often just plant. And, you know, most of our garden crops do much better at a neutral pH. And so that's something, that's probably the biggest rookie mistake that people make, just planting.
So soil testing, now that's
yeah,
what you do
exactly.
At UNH Cooperative Extension. Talk a little
that's
bit about
right.
that.
That's right. So UNH Cooperative Extension provides soil testing services, so do lots of other places. We test somewhere around 3,000 soil samples every year. And that's a good way to find out whether your pH is in the right ballpark, get some fertilizer recommendations, and really figure out what if you're gardening around your house, whether your lead levels are high, kind of important things to know.
All right. Rookie mistakes, Henry.
Rototilling. People think they want to start a garden. They take the lawn or the field and they just rototill the grass in. But that doesn't kill the grass. It just makes it angry. So it comes back to haunt you. You really have to strip the sod off if you're going to start a new vegetable garden.
Okay. That's
hard work. But you need to do it. And I agree with Becky that you don't want to take on more than you can do. So a small garden that you do well is wonderful. A big garden that you do poorly is very discouraging.
Well, and it's so hard, though, because you look at the seed catalog and everything looks so lush and beautiful and shiny, and it's just... It's like being a kid in a toy store. You know, it's hard to say no to that last seed packet.
It is. And when you get to the garden center and you see all these wonderful plants, you want to buy one of everything.
Or two of everything. So, again, you agree with Jane. Don't overreach. That's a rookie mistake.
Yeah.
Jane?
I think it's not a bad idea nowadays to know what your water is as far as getting a water test. If you have city water or if you have a deep well or dug well or whatever it is, I think that's an important factor, too, if you're going to be watering, and most people do end up watering their gardens.
All right. We will get to a lot more in just a moment. I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. We've got lots of Facebook comments already that I want to share with you. The phone number, though, for you to join us with your questions and comments for our gardening panel is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the phone number for you to call in with your gardening questions, challenges, frustrations, successes, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. And I do want to go to a couple of these Facebook comments, and this gets to just getting started. This is a Facebook comment from Crystal. She says, I just bought a house. We'll be closing at the end of the month. My question, is it too late to start planting certain veggies? And if not, what are the ones I could still get to produce something by the end of the season? Crystal says, I'm really hoping for kale and peppers specifically. Then she says, ha ha, which makes me think that she thinks it's too late. Is it too late, Becky?
It's not too late for kale. It might be too late for peppers if she doesn't close until the end of the month. End of June is pushing it pretty late for peppers in our short growing season. But we've had a series of really long, warm falls. And so planting, there are a lot of cool season vegetables, which you could even plant up until August or September and harvest through the fall. So spinach, all the cool crops, brassicas, kale is a good one. Broccoli, a lot of salad greens, lettuce, mesclun mixes. Those would all be something that she could still plant this season.
Henry, is it too late to get anything in? Sounds like Becky's saying no. What do you think?
I think that you have plenty of time to plant almost anything.
It was a pretty cold spring up until a week or so ago. So
that's right. Plants tend to catch up. If you plant your tomatoes too early, they sit in the cold ground and they're miserable. You plant them in mid-June and they're happy and they grow fast. And you can go to a garden center and buy full-size tomato plants to put in now, or even peppers that already have blossoms on them. So instead of starting something from seed, you're going to be buy the biggest plant you can if you're buying peppers.
So we may feel like, oh, we should do it, you know, the old-fashioned way from seed. But maybe, you know, Crystal's buying a house. It's a pretty busy time. Have no shame. Go to the garden store.
Absolutely.
Buy the plants. Yeah. What do you think, Jane?
Give it a shot.
Give it a shot. Thank you, Crystal, for the Facebook comment. And here's another one. Rebecca says, is it okay to stick a couple of tomato plants in my perennial garden? And Henry, I'm going to turn to you on this because I know you love flowers almost as much as vegetables.
And my answer is, sure, why not? It's your darn garden and you can do whatever you want. I grow artichokes in my flower gardens. They're beautiful plants.
Some people say also that there are certain flowers that actually detract, that keep pests away, like marigolds is the old wives' tale, right?
Yes. But I don't really know if that's true or not, but it certainly is an old tale.
It's pretty. They make you happy. So
right.
Why not?
Exactly.
Yeah. Jane, do you want to comment on
Rebecca's? I think it's a great idea to put vegetables in your garden. I think they...
In your flower garden.
In a flower garden, right. I think they're beautiful. I think singling out peppers that are colored peppers, or they have a variety of colors, like yummy peppers are yellow and green and red. And it's just eggplant or beautiful flowers with beautiful fruit. So you get lots of colors from your vegetables. And it's just be mindful where you're planting them in the right location in your garden. But I think they mix and match and just set off things with an entirely different look. So it's a good thing.
Well, and I'm guessing, too, that the bees and so forth, other pollinators also
Absolutely.
Like the flowers. So that helps out the vegetables.
Absolutely.
So there you go, Rebecca. And again, thanks for the comment. We'll take a lot more of your Facebook comments, emails, and your phone calls in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. More on gardening in the Granite State in just a moment.
This is NHPR. It's 919. Support this news service by becoming a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle at the $1,000 level. When you do, current Circle members Tillman and Sylvia Gerngross and Barbara and Dick Couch will add $500 onto your gift. Your money goes further today when you join the NHPR Leadership Circle. Just visit the support page at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Nathan Wexler and Company, professionals working together as a team to provide businesses and nonprofits comprehensive accounting and tax solutions, offices in Concord and Lebanon. And from the Lexus CT Hybrid combined EPA rated 42 mpg, actual mileage will vary. More at lexus.com/CT. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the joys and challenges of gardening in the Granite State. We have three expert gardeners with us in studio to take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. By the way, on our Facebook page, there's a great map of the hardiness zones in the United States. You can click on New Hampshire, see what zone you're in. That's on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, and on our website, nhpr.org. Here's an email, all of you, from Ken in Barrington. He says, I just built some new raised beds, and I'm about to plant a variety of vegetables in them. Can your panel discuss what methods they use to manage weeds? And I want to hear from everybody on this. Becky, I'm going to start with you. I'm thinking that weeds is a problem that a lot of listeners are dealing with.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest reason that people get frustrated gardening. And I think that Ken has started out really well in raised beds, because often raised beds are, they're a defined area, they're small, they're easy to manage.
They're sort of set off sometimes by wooden planks?
Yes,
or...
usually they're, yeah, exactly. They have a boundary. And so it's easier to keep control of weeds mechanically, just pulling them, if you're starting in a controlled setting like that. You know, one of the biggest sources of weeds when you create a raised bed is bringing in composts or manures that haven't maybe that bring weed seeds along with them, or soil that has weed seeds in there. So he may have a few to manage, but I think he'll have less trouble than if he was in a sort of a traditional in-ground garden setting.
So he's already off to a good start.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Henry.
I think that if you weed the way you brush your teeth, you'll be just fine, which is to say, do it every day. For a little bit of time, 5 minutes of weeding, if you have raised beds, you will never have a problem if you do it every day, 7 days a week.
The problem is we say, oh, we'll do it tomorrow, and then tomorrow becomes Sunday, and there's a million weeds out there.
But right after breakfast, go out and weed for 5 minutes. You'll be fine.
Jane?
Great advice. Weeds are, I agree, is the biggest problem that you have in gardening, whether it's flower gardening or vegetable garden, and you have to stay right at it. And you don't want to do the marathon weeding, because then it's discouraging about having a garden at all.
Yeah, then you say, I hate this. This is awful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you get up and you look out there and you go, yeah, I'll probably just rip it all out because I don't want to do it.
None of you guys use either newspaper or that black material, that webby material, that sort of surrounds? Because that's a good way to deal with weeds too, right? I mean, Henry, you're shaking your head.
Yes, I use newspapers with straw or a mulch hay on top around my tomatoes and big plants and in all the walkways.
It's
have a huge vegetable garden, and it cuts down tremendously on a weed problem if you mulch well. It also holds the moisture in a hot August.
Becky?
That's right. I agree completely. I use a lot of mulches in my gardens, and weeds need light to grow. And if you cover them up, then they don't have the capacity to grow. Another thing that I think that is very helpful to keep in mind when you're weeding is never let the weed set seed. So pull the weed out before it flowers, and then you're not going to be creating a worse problem going forward. So just don't let them get ahead of you.
And it doesn't look that pretty, the newspapers, but boy, it's easy. You just take them down, you settle them down with a couple stones, and you rip where they need to be ripped. Go ahead, Jane, and then let's go to our callers.
Yes, so the farm I use black plastic, especially in the hot weather crops such as peppers, eggplant. It keeps the moisture in the soil. It keeps the soil warmer. And so I have greater success earlier in the season. And it does suppress the weeds because there's no light. So it works very well. I also use the mulch. I use grass clippings, which are fine unless they're going to seed, and then you don't want to use those. Straw works well also. Different kind of gardening. The big field crops, so I run the plastic, either black or white.
All right. Let's take some calls. Our phone lines are full with people who want to ask you your opinion, your advice for their gardens this summer. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org, and Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And let's go to Catherine first. She's been waiting in Kittery Point, Maine. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a golden chain tree that in past years has been prolific. And this year, I probably only have a half a dozen chains. And I noticed there's another one along my way home along the coast, and it doesn't seem to be doing very well either. And I'm wondering if it might be the weather that we had.
You mean the long winter and the chilly until recently spring, Catherine?
Exactly. Yes, and I just looked at it closely last week to see if perhaps there were, some more chains coming, but it doesn't seem to be doing a whole heck of a lot. And it's usually, like I said, it's usually prolific.
Okay, Catherine, thanks for calling in. A golden chain tree, Henry. I've never heard of that.
Well, I've never grown one. I've read about them. But any tree that blooms early in the season sets its flower buds the year before. And we had a winter with 25 below zero and windy, and that killed some of those buds, most of those buds. That's happened on other trees as well. So it's growing a little farther north than it would prefer to be, I think. And it had a hard winter. But it'll be back next year in all its glory.
Okay, so fear not, Catherine, and thanks for calling in. Let's go next to Dover, where Sylvia's on the air. Hi, Sylvia. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I have a problem with stink bugs.
Stink bugs?
Yeah, and I was wondering if I have some stinging nettles, and I read online that stinging nettle compost tea might be very successful against infestation. So I was looking to get some information about maybe that being a way of managing the stink bugs.
Okay, Sylvia, thanks for the call. Becky, combating stink bugs.
Sure. It has been actually a bad few years for the stink bugs, not the invasive brown marmorated stink bugs that you may have read about in the news, but just our typical stink bugs.
What do they look like and what do they eat?
They look like they're sort of a shielded, shield-shaped hard insect.
Yes, I have seen those.
Yeah, they start sort of multicolored and then they eventually end up green or brown, and they eat all kinds of things.
Really?
Yes. Well, they mostly puncture and suck a lot of kinds of fruits and plants. So they have very broad host range. To tell you the truth, I haven't heard of stinging nettle as a possible control mechanism for them. There are a lot of options out there. I guess I would suggest, just not knowing that off the top of my head, I would suggest giving our Home and Garden Education Center Edline a call, and they can do the research and get right back to you on whether that would or would not work. My hunch is that it would not be effective, but that's just a hunch.
Well, good luck with the stink bug, Sylvia. And here's another question about pests from Facebook. Sarah says, how do you prevent and get rid of squash beetles and cucumber beetles? I know these are a big problem, Henry, for a lot of folks. Squash beetles. People hate these things.
Right. You can cover your cucumbers and squashes with a light agricultural fabric called row cover or Remay. Early in the season, I used to get my cucumbers eaten by striped cucumber beetles all the time until I started covering, but they're insect pollinated, so you have to be able to pull those covers off later on or you won't get any fruit.
So you cover the fruit,
cover the plant. No, you cover the entire plant.
But how does it get the sun that it needs?
It's a very light agricultural fabric, and the sun and water and air can go through it. Like plastic. It's like a very fine gauze, and it physically keeps the bugs from your plants. So row covers help, and later on, when the row covers have to come off when your plants are blooming, you've got a problem.
Jane, how do you deal with that?
I've used some row cover, but most of the time we don't. And when they arrive, I spray my plants.
You do? Yeah, what do you spray them with?
Well, I've used 7, which is a common thing that most people, I think, can't they, Becky? Yeah, they can buy 7 to put on it. And that works. They're difficult. Keep an eye. I think scouting your plants is really important to know when they're coming in so you can take care of it and not just spray to spray. And some people get nervous that they're coming in and they do that, which is not a good practice, you know. But, yeah, I default to that.
Spraying is controversial, as you know, because,
absolutely,
you know, it does get on the cucumber that you're going to eat. So how do you decide what and when to spray when it's something you're going to eat? So you obviously don't want to eat the spray.
Right. Well, there's also organic choices. So you have, you know, there's different divisions or classifications of chemicals that you can use. And read the labels. Anybody that's out there choosing, going to a garden center and looking at what is available, read to see when you apply them, how you apply them correctly. And, you know, you have a choice of liquid or you have a choice of powdery solutions or mixes. And once again, you need to know how to do the application correctly.
Here's another email about pests. And boy, we're getting a lot of comments actually on various pests, from the stink bugs to the squash beetles. Here's one I'm sure all of you have heard about. This is from Jerry in Dover. He says, we have a garden in Dover that's been destroyed by deer in recent years. A farmer in town told us that if we installed an electric fence, the deer can smell it and will not jump over it. I am very skeptical, Jerry says, and would like your guests' opinions. Becky, Henry, Becky,
yeah,
you want to start?
Sure. Electric fence is very effective at controlling, keeping deer out of a garden. We use them on all of our gardens at home. Commercial growers that I work with across the state use them. These are not, in order to keep deer out with a barrier, you need a very tall fence.
Right, because they can jump.
Because they can jump very high.
On the other hand, if they can smell them, like Jerry says.
Well, they don't exactly smell it. You train the deer, and it needs to be an electrified fence. It only needs to be about 4 feet high, 5 feet high, but typically we suggest training the deer by electrifying the fence, putting it there before the deer come into the garden, and wrapping foil over the electrified tape with a little bit of peanut butter on it. The deer come and sniff it, lick it, get a little shock, and then they're instructed not to go there.
Wow, that's tough love.
Well, it's effective.
Henry, do you use electric fences?
I don't. I have dogs, which works pretty
well,
too.
That works, right.
But Becky's right. The peanut butter on the electric fence is fabulous. I've seen it work in many places.
Okay, so if you don't like dogs or have dogs or for some reason can't have a dog, maybe you're allergic. But the electric fence gets to something that I wanted to ask all of you about. And I think I'll start with you, Becky, again, because you're dealing with a lot of first-time gardeners. I remember reading an article titled something like The $7,000 Carrot. And basically it was people grow because they say, oh, I'll save money. I won't have to go to the grocery store for, 5 months or 4 months. And then they end up, spending money on the electric fence and the expensive, fertilizer or the cover or the fences, the trellises, who knows what. So how do you budget this? I mean, it is possible to have $7,000 is obviously ridiculous. But the point is, sometimes you're not saving money if you're doing too much fancy stuff in your garden.
Well, that's certainly true. You can be very input and money intensive in your garden. One way to think about an electric fence, though, is that this is just as if we were budgeting as a farm enterprise. This is a long-term investment. That fence is going to last you for years, decades, perhaps. It's going to last you a long time. So this is, that it's not terribly expensive, and the cost is prorated. And if you can't get crops without it, I think that's for people that are in very high deer pressure areas, that it may be a worthwhile investment. But certainly budgeting, it's important.
Other pests like deer, Jane, raccoons or skunks,
bears.
Or anything. Bears, yeah, because even though you're in Concord, you're in a very rural part of Concord. What do you do?
Right. I do electric fence because the electric fence because of the deer problems that we have a lot. I think if you have a house and a garden that you're surrounded by woods or brush or open fields around your neighborhood, I think it's a really great thing to get your fences up.
Okay.
And I think bears, there's not much that can really keep them out when they want to come in.
Well, good luck, Jerry. Hope that advice helped. And let's go back to the phones and go to Chris in Bridgewater. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning. Great show. Thanks.
Sure. Go ahead, Chris.
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Somebody's favorite, many people's favorite crops. For the last several years, I have had a sort of a creeping wilt. That starts early in the season, in July, on the lower portions of the plant, works its way up, and by early August is affecting the whole plant and its productivity, so that the fruits that have set before then will come to fruition on the vine, but the vine will stop fruiting in early August. And I rotate the crop around the garden. It's not something that I've been able to identify online. With specific blotches or conditions of the leaves. And it seems to be a common problem. And I'm wondering if you could shed some light on that.
Sure. This happens year after year, Chris, not just last year.
It happened the last probably 3 years.
Wow. Okay.
Chris,
sorry to cut you off there. Let's go to you, Henry, and maybe you, Becky. Yeah. Tomato problems.
It is a very common problem.
Really?
Yes. Everybody has it once you've been growing for a few years. I've found that if I start a new garden for somebody in a lawn, cut up the sod, put it in, the first year there's no problem, the second year there's a little bit of a problem, third year. You can't rotate far enough. It's a soil-borne fungus, as I understand it, and it splashes up. So you can reduce splash by mulching. Tomato growers commercially, and Jane, you can speak about this, generally grow tomatoes inside big hoop houses where they can control the rain and the water, which causes a lot of the splash up.
So should he maybe just not grow tomatoes 1 year, give the soil a break from tomatoes?
It doesn't do it. It takes more than that.
Really?
Yes.
Jane and then Becky.
Yeah, I have them inside in greenhouses, and I use a fabric cloth on the ground or black plastic outside just to keep the water off the leaves. And it seems to help make the smalls not, I mean, the small, the holes for the plant not too big. And the other thing you can do is trim the leaves. It depends on whether you're also growing indeterminate or determinate plants.
What does that mean?
Some tomato plants are like 4 feet or shorter. Other plants will just grow to 7, 8, 9 feet, and you put them in cages, and you learn to prune them. So leaf pruning is also important. The shoots of tomatoes give off in indeterminates are just continuous as the plant gets taller. And so to have some control over putting the growth into your fruit versus having all the growth go into vegetation is also important. So if you go online and look up how to prune the two different types of plants, it's very helpful in controlling some of that.
So you're pruning leaves off your tomato plants or whole arms, those sort of long
branches as well as leaves?
Okay.
But the bottom leaves don't need to be sitting on the ground. You can get rid of those and it's not going to really affect your plant. And you can start pruning indeterminates probably when you get to the first blossom set. You can take off a few of the bottom leaves easily.
Okay. Well, that's probably a common problem, Chris, so thank you. I don't know if you want to talk any more about that, Becky, or...
Well, I think that Henry covered it,
okay.
The disease, pretty well. And
good luck with your tomatoes, Chris. I know it's like the number one thing that a lot of people in New Hampshire want to grow because you can't get a real tomato a lot of the times during the year. So thank you for that. James sent this comment on our Facebook page. He says, would your guests like to talk about community gardens? Now, Becky, that's a growing trend, right? People who don't have a big backyard plot decide, okay, let's get together as a community and do it that way.
Yeah, I actually don't know exactly how many community gardens there are in the state, but it's certainly, especially in urban areas, it's a really nice way for people to be able to garden, even if they don't have access to a lot of land.
Henry.
I agree. I think they're wonderful. There are a couple of hazards to growing in a community garden. One is that if you're organic and the guy next to you is spraying toxic chemicals, there may be spray drift, which I object to. I'm an organic gardener. You can also consider, if you're in the city, is having a 10-foot by 12-foot little tiny garden in your front lawn because there's sunshine in your front lawn. Plus, you'll weed it because your neighbors will make fun of you if you let it get too weedy, so you'll do better.
All right. Well, we will talk more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new recalls and more than 80 lawsuits, the future of General Motors. Then Los Angeles Times and NPR film critic Kenneth Turan on his all-time favorite movies. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is 20 minutes away here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from White Mountain Oil and Propane in North Conway, hosting its 33rd annual Bratwurst Broil and Community Open House this Friday, June 13th from 9 to 3. Details at whitemountainoil.com. And from the law firm of Orrin Reno, bringing sound judgment and a practical approach to New England's legal challenges for more than 65 years. Online at orr-reno.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a diabetes discussion, the outlook, research, and treatment of this increasingly prevalent disease. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, everything you wanted to know about gardening in the Granite State. Join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, challenges, frustrations, and successes of gardening in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. A panel of gardening experts is here to answer your questions. So give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. By the way, you can find the map of the U.S. hardiness zones posted on our Facebook page and on our website. It's pretty cool. You can click on New Hampshire, see where your town lies. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And waiting in New Durham is Dick. Hi, Dick. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for hanging on.
Oh, hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have two quick questions. The first one is about using grass clippings after you mow your lawn, using them as mulch. And my other question was just about using lime, the best way to use lime.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Dick, for the call. And Jane, I'm going to go to you first because I think you used... You talk about grass clippings, right? Yep. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I use grass clippings on my onions. It's easy to handle. It's cut small, so you can really spread them out. It makes a nice cover for any light going through. When it dries, it makes a nice mat, and it seems to suppress the weeds very, very well. As far as the using lime in your soil, I wouldn't put any lime down until I had a soil test.
Which gets to what we talked about before, Becky, right? The importance of getting your soil tested. Here's a Facebook comment from Ellen about soil. Anything on how to revive soil to make plants healthy as opposed to spindly ones? I've tried organic fertilizers, compost, and have resorted to miracle grow for my flowers. Just not sure what's wrong. I had the soil tested and it came back fine. I'd like to hear from you on soil, and you too, Henry, because I know this is an important issue for you. Just general thoughts on boosting her soil.
Well, certainly in a small garden setting, the best thing that you can do to increase your soil health is to add organic matter. So
compost.
Well, it can be compost. It can also be grass clippings. It can be straw mulch. It can be other crop residue. There's lots of ways you can add organic matter. It's all living stuff. And so increasing the organic matter is going to increase your water holding capacity. It's going to increase the nutrients available for plants. It's just going to have a lot of benefits all the way around. And so if the soil test is showing that everything is fine, but you're still not getting good growth, that may be part of what's going on. I think that would be a good temporary strategy, at least.
Well, we could probably talk for half an hour about compost, Henry. For some people, compost is almost like religion, you know, there's, you do this, you don't do that. But your thoughts also on how she can boost the soil.
Get the soil fluffy. She may have compacted soil, particularly if it's a clay-based soil. It can get compacted and then roots really have a hard time getting out. So when you plant a flower, don't just make a hole the size of the root ball, but loosen up the soil in a much wider diameter circle. Add compost to it. Work that compost in. You don't need a lot of fertilizer. In fact, annual flowers do better without too much fertilizer, or you get a lot of leaf and not very many flowers.
Interesting. And I also was reading yesterday, Henry, something about compost. And if you put compost in before it's fully baked, so to speak, even if there's just a little bit of, you know, banana peel or whatever left in it, you're going to create a problem in your soil. You're going to create real problems for your plants. You might even end up putting too much nitrogen in the soil or something like that. You really got to time that compost thing right.
I think it's good not to worry about it too much.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't get stressed over compost.
Right. And you know what? I buy compost. You can't make enough compost from the leftover mildewed broccoli in the back of the fridge. You have to buy compost if you're going to be a gardener. And
really?
Yeah. Good quality compost in bags, or now most garden centers will sell it by the pickup truckload.
Now, I'm surprised to hear you say that. You have to buy compost. I had this vision of you.
I make my own, but I also buy it.
Because you want to put a whole bunch in there.
Yeah, yeah. I buy it by the truckload.
Jane?
I buy it in bulk.
Yeah, and you're a farmer, so it's a little different. Yeah,
and you buy it by the ton. You bring it in, put it in your fields.
And
you
make
know what you have.
Too.
I have a compost pile at home, but I don't use any of that compost for 1.5, 2 years out. To let it really break down, and you have to mix it, aerate it, mix it as you put things into it with soil.
It's easy to get pretty geeky about compost, Becky.
Yes, yes it is. We have livestock at home, and so that's a really good, the manure is a great source of compost, so it's a good reason to have livestock, aside from the joy they bring you.
Let's take another call, and let's go to John in Peterborough. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. John, good morning. You there? All right. Well, hopefully John will call back. I want to remind John and everybody that the phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's a call from Guildhall, Vermont. Rose is with us. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. You're
on
the exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. My question is that we have raised beds and the soil is very good, lots of compost. But I've lost a couple of transplants, tomatoes and eggplants, to grubs this year for the very first time. We're also organic gardeners. I don't want to use anything that's harmful to bees, birds, and any animals. And I wondered if you guys had any suggestions.
Okay. Henry, I'll turn to you first on that one.
Well, it's hard to diagnose when she says grubs, what really is going on there. Becky, what do you think?
I would suspect cutworms.
Yes, that's it.
That would be my top guess in a nice fertile soil like that. And what cutworms do, they live in the soil. And at night, they come out of the soil and they cut off your plants. And so oftentimes, you can physically remove them in a small environment like that, because where a plant has been cut off, you go and you root around just the base of that plant with your fingers in the soil about 1 to 2 inches deep, and you'll often find the cutworm, the culprit, curled up in a little C shape, and you can get them out of there.
Wait, you're saying you have to dig in the dirt?
Yeah, there.
And pull out disgusting little squishy
bugs?
Oh,
he's not disgusting. He's just a little caterpillar-looking thing in a C shape.
You're not getting me excited,
He's
Becky.
Quite attractive. Just take him out, and then he won't do any more damage. There are ways to get around that, though. If cutworms are the culprit, putting collars, as silly as that sounds, but Dixie cups with the bottoms cut off right around each plant, that will prevent the cutworm from getting there, getting at the base of those plants.
That's a nice low-tech way to do it.
Yeah.
Did you want to jump back in there?
No, I
think
she's covered it perfectly.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again for that call, Rose, and good luck to you. Here's an email from Robert in Epson. He says, 3 or 4 seasons ago, my lovely wife dumped a whole contractor wheelbarrow full of wood ash sweeten the soil. That's an appropriate comment. Because he says to sweeten the soil of a living room-sized garden plot. Robert says the subsequent seasons of vegetable gardens have been neither lovely nor sweet. What, oh, what shall we do? So I guess, Henry, ash is not a good idea.
It's the quantity, not the quality.
I see. Okay.
That was way too much. So get a soil test, find out what your pH is. Then you're going to have to add sulfur or a sulfur-added fertilizer such as Holytone to the soil to bring that pH down. It may be well above 7.0, and I've seen it happen where you couldn't even grow zucchini because somebody put down too much wood ashes. If a little is good, a lot is not better.
Interesting, because I had read that wood ash was not a bad idea, but you're saying only in small amounts.
Yes.
Okay. I did have another question that I wanted to ask all three of you. And Jane, I want to start with you. We talked earlier about New Hampshire's short growing season. What about climate change, though, Jane? Does a warmer climate mean a longer growing season, which could be good for small farmers, backyard gardeners?
I've done the farming game for a very long time, and I think that to have a longer season would be wonderful for New Hampshire. The thing that I'm seeing as a trend over my lifetime has been that with this climate change, which I think there really is, obviously, I see more erratic temperatures. The highs are higher, the lows are lower.
That's tough on the plants.
And inconsistent. This season is a pretty good example of that, having some warm weather, and it looks like it's going to be time to plant because the calendar is about the right time to do that. And we have a cold trend for 5 days. And then we have a wet, rainy for 10 days with a couple of days of sun here and there. So I think the weather is inconsistent in the climate change. And I think that it's going to be for a while longer until we settle into a pattern. Mother Nature doesn't move. It moves quickly, but at the same time, slowly in the bigger picture.
So on the face of it, you would think, okay, you know, a warmer planet, you know, has obviously lots of problems, but it might mean a slightly longer growing season. But you're seeing a lot of problems because it's so erratic.
Right. And I think the plants you normally have go into the fall. If it's too warm, that's not good for them either, because they're cold crops that go into the winter and fall. Or harvesting potatoes. Do the potatoes start to race because it's so warm during the summer, so you're harvesting them earlier? So I think that there's some kind of link between how you plant, when you plant, how long it's going to be before you harvest them, and what's the right time. So
I want to hear from everybody on this, actually, and then we'll go back to our listeners. What have you seen, Henry, in your many, many years of gardening with climate change and how it's affected your business?
I'd say just that it's erratic. I agree with her that we don't know. Of course, we've never really known. It's always a juggling act, and you try to hedge your bets and plant things at different times, a little of this and a little of that, rather than putting all of your crop in exact on the same day. You can stagger things, and you can try planting for fall crops as well as spring crops. So I'll plant broccoli by seed on July 10th.
Wow, that's late.
And then it's for a fall crop.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have a long fall, broccoli's not very frost. It's not afraid of frost. It'll keep on producing till Thanksgiving.
So in terms of climate change, you're seeing more erratic weather, but we've always had that in New England. Is that what you're saying?
That's my feeling, yes.
Yeah? Becky?
Well, we certainly, yeah, weather is erratic in New England. One of the things we are seeing a lot more, and the models suggest we're going to see even more, is a lot of severe rain events in spring and fall. And those are particularly challenging in the spring for farmers to deal with and gardeners.
Because you've got little baby plants.
You have little plants and you have flooding. And if you're not in a very well-drained area, it stresses the roots. Then a little bit of warm temperature and the plants are experiencing a tremendous amount of stress. Last year, our potato crop, four plantings were killed by flooding.
That's frustrating.
It's very frustrating. So I think that what Henry just said about having to be a little more resilient and perhaps hedge your bets by planting at different times and trying to sort of anticipate that variability is going to be the way we'll have to cope with it.
So I've heard predictions, and I think these came from the climate scientists at UNH, Becky, that New England can expect a wetter future, maybe even 20% wetter. So, all right, let's start thinking about planting along those lines.
Well, right. And unfortunately, we would like to think that maybe it would be consistently wetter or, you know, something where we could predict, but it really looks as though that increased wet is going to happen during the fall, winter, and spring, not necessarily during the summer. So counterintuitively, we might actually see more drought. And I think it's just going to be stressful for crops.
Let's take another call. This is Will in Berlin. Hi, Will. You're on the exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. This is Will Bryan, president of the Quaw County Botanical Garden Club in partnership with Northern Human Services from Berlin, New Hampshire. And I received a lot of calls about impatient blight and was wondering if you had any answers. Do we have it in our area? How can we prevent it?
Yeah, and impatiens is great because it's beautiful. It flowers all summer long. It works well in the shade. Anybody want to jump in on that? Henry? Becky?
So I think what you're referring to is the impatiens downy mildew, which came into New Hampshire and throughout New England actually two seasons ago. Last summer it was much more sporadic, but it's a pathogen that blows in on storm weather clouds during the summer, and it came in and it pretty much kills the impatiens. End of story. So we had impatiens pretty much melting across New England 2 years ago. Last year, we had a reduction. We didn't see it. It was sporadic, a little bit here and there, but not certainly the widespread occurrence. It's very hard to predict whether it will come or it won't come. We're just dependent on weather and whether it's in the air. So, again, that would be a case of we just don't know. You have to hedge your bets, perhaps. Don't rely exclusively on impatiens.
All right.
Right.
There are other
plants that you can grow. Terrinia is a nice annual that you can grow in the shade.
Okay, I hadn't heard of that.
New Guinea impatiens is a nice one that's not it's in the impatiens family, but it's not susceptible to that particular fungus.
New Guinea impatiens.
Yes.
Okay.
The trouble is you can't buy it as cheaply as you can the six packs of impatiens that people would buy, you know, 4 6 packs and they'd have a ton of it. And these other things are sold in 4-inch pots generally, so it's much more expensive.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call. And I was not aware of that problem. So thank you for calling in, Will. And let's take one more if we could. This is Jen in North Conway. Hi, Jen. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
I have a vegetable garden and I'm wondering, is there something I can plant that can keep my cats from using it as a litter box?
Your cat uses your vegetable garden as a litter box, Jen?
Yes.
Thank you for the call. Okay, Henry's got dogs, but go ahead.
Yes, you can keep your cats out physically by laying some branches over the newly turned soil. Once the soil's been, you've got plants growing in there, and if you put down some mulch, they won't be interested. It's the new plantings they want. So if you've got some roses that you pruned back or some apple trees, just spread the branches out over the soil, and that'll keep them out, and they'll get out of the habit.
Jane?
I think that's a great suggestion. Yeah, I don't have a suggestion for keeping cats out.
Becky, that's another one, too. Okay, I hope that helps, Jen. Thank you very much for calling in. You know, we talked about the tough winter and how it's been sort of a chilly up until recently spring. Jane Presby, I think I'll throw this to you. I have two rose bushes. We haven't talked that much about flowers this hour. As we close out, I love both of them. Look forward to them coming back in the spring. And this year, both of them just seem dead. Should I yank them out or should I just hold on and maybe they'll come back next year?
By now, you should know if they're going to do really? Anything or not. Aww. Yeah, the roots are probably dead if the whole complete stem, the crown is gone. So it'd probably be gone and start over. And the other thing with roses, your location is really important. You want them on the south side, not windblown.
Oh, they're in a great location. Yep. They've always been lovely. Every year I look forward
low
to them.
Low temperatures.
And, yeah.
They get below a certain temperature and it's hard for them.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. It was fun to see all of you, and we will put a lot more resources on our website, our Facebook page. The conversation continues there. Also, that hardiness zone map is on our Facebook page and on the website, so check it out. Jane Presby, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Jane Presby, owner, CEO, field supervisor of Diamond Hill Farm in Concord. Henry Hohmeyer, it was good to see you too. Thank you for
your
time.
My pleasure.
Henry Hohmeyer, lifelong organic gardener, author of a weekly gardening column, and author of four books on gardening. And Becky Seidman, thank you also for your time.
My pleasure.
Becky Seidman, extension professor and sustainable horticultural specialist at UNH. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a diabetes discussion. Nearly 20 million Americans are diagnosed with the type 1 or type 2 forms of this disease. And with predictions that these numbers will only continue to grow, many are exploring new approaches to diabetes and having some success, including at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock here on NHPR, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from German Auto Works in Concord, servicing Volkswagen, Audi, and now BMW. Welcoming technician Jody McCormack with 16 years BMW service experience. Details at 228-2834. And from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, everything made from organic and sustainable materials. Also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. General Motors CEO Mary Barra meets with shareholders today. It's her first public appearance since GM's internal review was made public last week and detailed the company's 11-year failure to recall cars with defective ignitions.